Hello everybody, welcome to the Boxing Science Podcast, episode 26, and this is a free workshop taster from the Boxing Science Conference 2022. This is our sports science roundtable discussion, where we've brought together some of the leading practitioners in the UK currently working in boxing to share their thoughts and ideas around a range of different subjects, from injury management to recovery tools, what we need to do to evolve the sport of boxing. This roundtable discussion includes myself, Danny Wilson, Rob Madden, physiotherapist, Gary Hutt, who's the lead strength conditioning coach for GB Boxing, and also the head of performance at GB Boxing and physiotherapist, Ian Gatt. Like just mentioned, this is from the Boxing Science Conference 2022, and the online edition is now available on the Boxing Science website. To celebrate the launch, we're offering a massive 60% discount, and this sale finishes on Friday 30th of September. Don't miss out on these 12 educational workshops from the leading practitioners in boxing and MMA, all available at your fingertips.
I'm going to just start off from left to right. Just how have you got into boxing and what kind of excites you in working in boxing? Start with you, Ian.
Yeah, you know, sometimes people ask me, you know, have I boxed before? And I say, no, I know I look like a boxer, you know, maybe a bit prettier. You know, I started, you know, my background has always been in sports. As a physiotherapist, it's one thing I wanted to do. And 22 years later, I'm still involved in high level sports. But I'll be honest, at the time I did a 2-year stint with GB Volleyball. It was before London, as you know, they had set it up and everything. And they were looking for somebody to head the physiotherapy. And so they asked me. And the first day, I still remember, I went up and there was Tom Stalker, maybe you know him. And I couldn't understand a word he was saying, he's Scouser. And I thought, shit, I'll need a translator to do this job now. Luckily, I understood everything after that. And I've been 13 years now in boxing. And I'll say I have massive passion and massive admiration for what the boxers do, for example, because it's tough going in that ring. 2010, actually, we did, we actually prepared and we did like a white collar. So all the support stuff and some members of staff, we actually boxed each other. And it was a very interesting experience. So I'll say any sport you can turn up for except boxing, because for boxing, you have to prepare. Even when it feels it's not the right thing. That's me.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, probably similar to Gat. I bounced around quite a bit. I've been in different situations, working for myself, working for organisations, NGBs, professional sport, university sport. So I kind of been around the houses and In fact, funny story, I saw Danny doing boxing science and I was working in volleyball at the time. So my great idea working for myself was to try and do boxing science for volleyball, which was volley science. Now
I've copyrighted that, by the way, so I'm going to sue him.
It wouldn't be worth it because it fell on his ass. And that's where I think I've got massive respect for the guys here, because I can completely understand the work they're having to do to put in to try and support the network of coaches and everything like that in boxing. I ended up falling into boxing, and I kind of, as Gat said, I walked into the gym at GB Boxing on my first day. And I had a conversation with Gat and I thought, fucking hell, I'm going to need a translator now as well. But going from a sport like volleyball, which is quite an affluent sport, like it's quite moneyed, into a sport like boxing, where you get people from all different kind of walks of life, all different experiences. I think it's been a really, really enjoyable challenge to try and engage people on the right level for that. And particularly like one of the stories that really caught me when I first started was working with gypsy and traveller populations. So I was lucky. I went down to a workshop in Wales. They were running kind of how to work with gypsy and traveller communities, because like a kid that I was working with had never been to primary school. Like, how do you engage on a personal level when you've got such a different life experience? But I think that's one of the fantastic bits about this sport. Like, you can get that, and then you can work across with a different athlete who's studied a master's and is working towards being like as highly educated as they can possibly be in academia. Like, I think it's the breadth of challenge is fantastic.
So, well,
yeah, actually, following on from that, weirdly, I was physio for about 14 years now and did the S&C a bit later on. But when I was working in North London in a small practice, I used to manage, well, I used to look after like a dozen travellers, and it was always pretty eye-opening. And I remember I scanned one of their hands on an ultrasound, and there was an obvious break from his, he'd just been training probably without gloves. And I remember showing him the break and saying, look, oh, your hand's broken, like you need to put it in some plaster and rest. And he was like, I can't do that. There's, you know, there's a lot of money on the fight, is what he said. So that was my first exposure to boxing. I quite enjoyed it. They were challenging, but gave me a little unique insight. And then I moved into central London, and my colleague and these guys worked with him as well, Mike Loosemore, just through the situation I was in, I ended up getting introduced to a few boxers at the time that were looking for, they were transitioning from amateur to pro. They needed physio in London, support in London, and that always worked quite well between Sheffield and London, as I said, with Joshua. So most of my work over the last 8 years with Ian has been with him, but I've helped a handful of other fighters as well. I don't have such a dense background in boxing, but got a big love for it as well. And it's great to be here, learning a lot today. And yeah, it's just nice to see everyone just pushing boxing and boxing science and the industry to just keep evolving.
Cool. So you mentioned about kind of boxing evolving, and a big thing about this conference is mapping out the future for what sports science delivery is in boxing and bringing people to get the best practitioners together to help educate the community. But before we start going on to the future, let's talk about the past. And Ian, you've probably got the most experience in boxing, probably when sports science and strength conditioning was in its very, very early days. What were them days like, and what were the challenges that you had, and maybe what are the biggest changes that you've seen over the past 13 years?
It's like going back in the dark ages of boxing. The thing is that there were a lot of myths, and either probably these myths sometimes they transpire even potentially in boxing clubs. I remember two of the biggest ones for me were, one was around strength training. Because if you do strength training, you're going to put on weight. Obviously, if you do it wrongly, you will. But that was the big myth. So obviously, at the time, it wasn't under McCracken's PD. It was different PD at the time. So they had a different philosophy. So S&C was pretty much had one hand tied behind the back in trying to do things. And all of the injuries I was seeing, I knew they could be resolved with proper S&C. Example, lots of back injuries that actually with proper S&C you don't get. Back injuries from sport. The other one, which was the most interesting one, was when a boxer was injured, I used to send them home. And I put up my hand and said, so what's my job? So what do you mean? Well, if they're injured and they're not here, how do I get them better? So it made them scratch their head a little bit. Mm. So the whole idea that actually, when a boxer is injured, they have to be in the environment. So if somebody's injured, even for you guys, make sure they still come to the gym. If they injure their one hand, they can still train with the other hand, is it? If they injure a foot, they can still do other things. I think one of the things that we've learned over the years is you can adapt things. And that's why, for me, it's important that the therapist works with the coach, because the coach can give some great ideas. So we introduce things like the noodles. You know, somebody has a hand injury and you want to impact less. We've got the noodles now. In the back in the days, they used to think it was a fallacy to use noodles, but lots of people use them for technical things these days. Water bags, you know, in a lot of gyms, I ask the question, do you have a water bag? No, I don't have a water bag, and all my bags are hard. Make sure you've got some water bags in there, even to offload the hands a bit. So there's a lot of gems we've learned over the years to try and make not just injury management a better experience, but prevention. So yeah, I think we've evolved massively. And I remember when we started, we were maybe 4 or 5 sports science working at GB Boxing. Now we've got 15, 16, including myself. So GB Boxing has invested into sports science and medicine to make sure that obviously the athlete gets the best experience to be able to do what they can do best, at least at an Olympic level. In the professional world, obviously, it's who they surround themselves with to be able to get to that level.
Cool. So we're saying about a kind of long-term change there. What about that kind of short-term? What have you seen in the past 3 years, potentially looking at the last cohort of Olympians and amateur boxers coming through the system compared to you've got kind of new ones coming in? Have you seen a bit of a shift to their openness to strength conditioning?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. Like when Ian was talking then, it made me think of my first experience with GB. So I came into boxing with no experience of working with any kind of fighting sports before, which seems interesting, doesn't it? And I think I might have pulled the wool over his eyes in employing me, really. But the first trip that I went on was 4 days after I started in GB. It was into Belarus, and it was literally 2 foot of snow everywhere. The gym was a little sweatbox gym, not much bigger than this place, with no windows. You had 1,000 people standing around waiting for all of the spars. And my job in that environment was to get to know the athletes and deliver some form of S&C without any equipment. So being able to react and be dynamic and adapt and change, I think, is like is a huge challenge for, I'm sure, you guys in the environments that you're in, but also like all the way through the system. And I think actually that becomes like the biggest opportunity and the biggest skill to really secure what you do. And then in terms of reflections on like the last few years, it's really interesting. I don't know whether you think this as well, Ian, but the cohort for Tokyo was really well embedded and solid and had a lot of experience, had been in the GB system for a long time, and they obviously knew how to operate. Yeah. And there was a way of operating. With this new cohort, particularly with elements to do with COVID, where they've perhaps not had as much exposure because they haven't been able to travel, they're on a much earlier developmental stage, which is a challenge, but it also raises opportunities again with the coaches being really open to explore new things, whereas they knew what worked before. So being able to communicate, engage and develop a program now, is there's probably a change there, I think. And then perhaps a lifestyle piece where boxers like to have fun, don't they? A lot of boxers like to have fun, and there's perhaps more boxers having fun in the boxing gym and in the S&C facility now than there were in the previous cohort. And that makes life a little bit easier, but it also brings accountability, which is important to be able to step up and deal with.
Yeah, cool. One of the key words that you said there was communication, and it actually came up in both Ian's and Rob's presentation on, you know, we're talking about protecting the upper limb, protecting the neck, and one of the key things are communication. Rob, you've been part of a big team with Anthony Joshua and other boxers and other athletes as well. What key things do you need to see from communication to make sure that that athlete is progressing in the right way?
Yeah, I mean, it's the most important thing. And I think what we got into good habits with is communicating everything from the big things to the tiny things. And you can't over-communicate. And if I go back over my career and think about all the unnecessary challenges, negative things that may have happened, even mistakes that I've made, normally falls back to communication being weak. And I still occasionally get caught out, but I think even comes back to your personal life, like not communicating with your wife, it gets you in trouble. So, you know, communication is everything. And, you know, one thing I would say as a sidestep is, following on from what these guys said just now, I think what I've seen evolve, particularly over the last 3 years, is technology. I think it's amazing what we have access to now. Everything from punch trackers to recovery trackers with your Oura Ring and your Whoops to great heart rate monitoring and all these systems that we have. What I feel that we're still lacking is really consolidating that data to get the best out of the fighter with the coach. I still think that there's a big loophole there. Obviously, within the GB system, they've got a very robust system that they follow. I think it gets harder when you go into like environments with the pro fighters to have that. But that there's a big overlap there between that type of data, whether you're measuring resting heart rate, HRV, body temp, during the training, maybe during the night, How much access do you give the athlete to that data? Because it can infect them positively or negatively. But what we had with the big guy was we had great communication between our performance analyst and us. So Chris Connolly, so he keep track of all the punch data as well as the polar heart rate data to see, okay, is there anything weird going on? You know, is his heart rate particularly high and he's overtraining, or maybe he's on the cusp of getting a cold, and knowing when to pull back. And that feeds directly into the communication to say, okay, we would have an email system of that data being shared, and Gat, myself, and Mike Loosemore being able to comment from a medical perspective to say, cool, his volume has gone up 20% on that. Let's just watch out for that. So yeah, communication is the most important thing. And I think what I'm excited to see is how technology keeps evolving and how we can use it.
Yeah, I think a key thing that you said there was in the professional environment, I find it quite challenging for communication and being part of a multidisciplinary team, because obviously at GB Boxing, you get allocated a sport through the EIS and your team is based around boxing. Whereas like, I think that professionals can just pick up a strength conditioning coach from one place, nutritionist from another. You know, I've got athletes that see different sports masseurs, different physiotherapists, chiropractors. I never get through a report on how they're getting on and everything. So it's really important to get that communication, see what's happening. Because with the athlete, when you ask them, like for example, somebody with an elbow injury, like what kind of elbow injury is it? You know, what kind of pain are you feeling? What's your physio said, sir, chiropractor? And they're just like, well, the pain's just there, and without no like kind of real diagnosis, nothing for me to kind of work with. So yeah, I find that as a challenge, especially when I have different boxers coming from different gyms, and then they all have their individual preferences as well. Let's go to like a more structured approach. Obviously, leading GB Boxing Sports Science and Medicine team, what are the key processes to make sure you're keeping on top of that communication from different disciplines?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing I'd say with communication, I'll say the two biggest blockers of communication are assumptions and egos. If you take away those two, it flows. If you take away the fact that people assume that other people will know, I always say assumption is the evil of our roots. I'll probably put it on my grave when I die. Because people say, I assume that. And whenever you assume something, you should stop yourself and think, maybe I should check with that person to know what they know. The other thing is egos. For some reason, the higher you go up, the less ego you should have. Because the more comfortable you should be with yourself. So there's a lot of people out there who've got an ego, massive ego, which is a shame, really, because if you're working, for example, with a very good athlete who's got a lot of coverage and everything, the last thing you need is an ego, because you, by association, you're going to get whatever exposure you want or whatever, but people still want to fight and try and chomp at the bits and everything. And if people are on the fringe, they have a worse ego, because then they don't want to help you because they want to take all the attention. It's a horrible thing, is it? Physios fighting with S&Cs, S&Cs with physios and everything. So how do we bring everything together? So one of the things that we did in January, as an example, we do individual athlete plans. So I sat down in 31 meetings in January, not fun, 20 minutes per athlete. And every athlete had their point of contact coach, because in boxing they've got a point of contact coach, and the support stuff which were relevant to the athlete. So it's not everybody, otherwise it becomes a big meeting. Relevant. And what we did is we trashed out their plan. What competitions are you going this year? What are your strengths? What are certain threats or work-ons? And we make sure that they had a clear understanding of what was happening. And that's sort of almost like a very big formal thing. But the other thing we do is every Tuesday, as Gary knows, we meet as a sports science and medicine team, and we do it a hybrid. So people are on the screen, people are on the ground. COVID has taught us that you can actually do that really well. We've got the WhatsApp groups, we've got the gym informally, we've got the corridor conversations. But one of the things I think we're really good at GB is we talk about things. And what I do like is, rather than people say, oh, Gata's the manager, people will come to me and say, look, I've heard this. Are you aware of this? And as a point of contact, then I can let other people know who maybe, I don't know, if Gary was thinking something is only relevant for a physio, I might say, yeah, but have you thought about the nutritionist? Oh, yeah, good point. But equally, they sometimes tell me that, you know, have you thought about this? And so, you know, when you include people and you take away the egos, it's not about one person, it's about the athlete and the bigger good of things. So all I have to do is facilitate communication with people. I don't like to say I manage people. I facilitate those communications and the processes just to make them do a better job.
Cool. So have we got anything to add on that, Gary, at all? Or?
He's going to say it's bullshit.
No. the biggest challenge with, like, the Olympic sport versus the pros is that, like, we're dealing on scale. So where it might be a really close one-on-one relationship with an athlete in the pros where you know them inside out, and although you haven't got the team to be able to kind of communicate really effectively, we've got to, like Gat said, communicate about 31 at least, really. Yeah,
before to two.
So 42 up to 50 at one point, like, athletes on that level, and everybody stay on the same page. So although the individual athlete planning process that Ian's kind of just outlined, which is actually working super well at the moment, doesn't always work super well. And you have to put those steps in place and make the effort to be able to work it. It doesn't just happen. And that's not just boxing, though. That's in a range of Olympic sports. Like, I know we've probably all worked across different sports and different teams, and there's not many situations where that, like, flow of communication works really, really smoothly. You have to work at it all the time. So I think that's the only addition I'd add. Like, everybody has to work hard on the unseen things.
Cool. I'm just going to touch on what Rob said about, like, technology. And technology is growing, and obviously we're making best use of it. What's the one thing that you want to see in terms of, like, sports technology that can be applied to boxing and that can better your practice? And I'll spread that across the three of you.
That's a really exciting topic. And I think we're in that spot where we could have too much data. Mm-hmm. Rio Ferdinand actually did a great interview on it a few years back where he talked about sports science wrecking football because there was too much information and too much data to kind of almost take away from the athletes getting resilience. Like, oh, your urine's slightly off colour, you're not hydrated, you know, don't train just yet, work on your fluids. You're all right. You know, George Best used to go out and get drunk and he'd still turn up to training. So there's this kind of evolution of the science, but we've got to be careful that we're still encouraging resilience with the athletes. And if the data we're getting is a bit off, it doesn't necessarily mean that they always need to rest. So what to answer your question, what would I like to see improve? I guess I would like to see the systems become a bit more robust, that we can almost all use the same system to say, okay, we're taking this data, ABC data, and we can argue what that is, whether it's just training data, nighttime data, to then inform us, and probably punch trackers, at least intermittently, to inform the team to say, okay, we're on track, no concerns, because ultimately our first priority and our top priority is health. The fighter has to stay healthy. And then just very, very slightly underneath that is maximal performance. But they're nothing without health. So we have to maintain that. And for me personally, using the Oura ring has been really interesting, and seeing, like, tracking long-term data on heart rate, HRV. HRV brings lots of challenges in itself, but looking at trends to know, okay, this looks a bit off. You know, how are you feeling subjectively? Coupling how they feel subjectively with the data to speak to the coach and say, right, this is the plan for the week, but we need to change it. We need to drop the intensity. We need to drop the load. I'd love to hear from you guys on that, because you've probably got some pretty robust systems. But yeah, that's my kind of nutshell on it.
So for me, like, on the thing that first jumped out to me when you posed the question was, like, I look at a sport like cycling or a closed sport where their systems from an S&C point of view specifically are in place so that they understand like the change in the gym and how that impacts the change in performance. Big challenge in boxing is understanding actually physiologically and mechanically what's happening in the ring. I'd love to see us move further and closer to understanding more about, like the guys have referenced in presentations, punch force management. What are we dealing with in a clinch and how do we maximize strength gains towards that? Like energy system usage within a 3-3s. Like what we see profiles of the way that boxers box, but how's that underpinned by the physicality? And I think we can make like logical assumptions at the moment, but nothing in depth to really drive at the data. But then having said that, I think just coming full circle to the kind of the health monitoring, the challenge that we've got almost is like, say there's too much data and there's a difference between a data-driven approach, which is only focused on that kind of number and what's changing in that number, and a data-informed approach where you're trying to take that in context with some of the other subjective information that's going on. And I know that we're trying to take a really kind of data-informed approach with, say, the daily monitoring that Jamie Mitchell, our physiologist, does a great job with. And a lot of the time when you sit back and you read the research into like daily monitoring, it comes back to if you can get a subjective read of how someone's feeling, it's probably going to tell you what the data says.
Yeah.
So if you've got a good system around having conversations and coming back to communication, it's almost trumps a lot of the data, but coming at it from both ends and having that objective measure of yes, the HRV is looking good, hydration is looking good, training load's looking good, coupled with the fact that the athlete's telling you they're feeling class, mm-hmm. is covering all bases, isn't it? Yeah.
Good. Anything to add on that, Ian?
Yeah, I mean, if you think, you know, as we said, there's so many things out there you could be testing forever. If you think about how best can we measure the intensity of a boxer, interestingly, Tim Gabbett in one of his recent papers said that the best measure anybody can use is RPE. And you think about what Rob was showing there with the neck was RPE. And that's very subjective. And you're thinking, yeah, but where are the numbers there? But yeah, they're very subjective numbers. But interestingly, the person will know. And I can tell you from experience, whenever I've returned somebody back to training, whenever I told them you need to hit at 50%, I used to tell them you have to hit at 50% and you have to trust that. So RP, and if you're hitting a water bag at 100% and then you progress from there, and we've always managed to progress boxes safely using that RPE on the equipment. However, we've had then the quantitative data like a hand grip dynamometer, an isokinetic machine, those exercises I showed you, that you give you the numbers, but that's the crossover is numbers where you can maybe be in the gym and test certain parameters. But then when you cross over in the gym, you can use a lot of that. And so RPE can become a really good one for sort of your own interpretation of things. The other thing also, sometimes people say, okay, from an injury point of view, when do you know that somebody's ready to return? And again, if you look at a big sport like football, they've looked at a lot of parameters, including all the machines and everything. And one of the biggest thing is readiness to return. An athlete feeling ready to return. Obviously, always good to be coupled with some baseline numbers. So, you know, the shoulder, again, go back to these tests we talked about. But if you're trying to turn somebody based on your data only, and you know, ask them, are you feel ready to return? And they're not ready to return. Trust me, beyond the numbers, they're going to get injured again. Because boxing is a very psychological sport, beyond possibly even other sports. If you're not ready to do something, you're going to fail at it. So you need to make sure that, equally though, sometimes some boxers feel they're ready to return and they're not ready to return. So I'm not saying that you have to use all of that. So as Gary said, it's informed data, but always speaking to your boxer, always asking the questions about how they feel.
Cool. So just before we open it up for questions. Just want to ask each this question because me and Alan sat down a few times to record this podcast and for some reason we haven't actually done it. And it's because we had an interesting discussion on our WhatsApp group where we shared what was the article, the football, what's expected in the next 10 years of football. And we were thinking what's expected for the next 10 years of boxing, what needs to change to help improve sports science delivery in boxing. So we have a lot of things written down. I'm sure that we're going to record it at some stage. But whilst I've got you guys here, I just wanted to see what you feel is needed within the next 10 years to help improve sports science delivery in boxing. We'll start with yourself, Ian.
One of the things is making sure that they feel that the sport is safe. Yeah. I think there's a lot of criticism. You know, I love boxing to bits. I think it's safer than a sport like rugby, for example, because there is a bit more control in it. However, there's a lot of people out there that feel that boxing isn't safe. So how can we make it safer? You think about what Madden was showing before. Can we make it safer by actually conditioning certain areas? How can we reduce the injuries? So for me, it's about how can we make sure that every boxer, every gym has better access to knowledge to make somebody less likely to get an injury, whether it is the upper limb, whether it is the neck, and equally, how can they manage them better once they get an injury? And I reckon that over these next 10 years, especially with you guys being more knowledgeable, more in the gyms and everything, we'll see boxers hopefully with less severe injuries, or even when they get severe injuries, they're managed much better from the onset.
Cool. What about yourself, Guy?
I kind of come back to the communication piece a little bit. I think some of the biggest barriers in terms of like relationships are based on like the ability to listen, the ability to kind of actively be in the moment around stuff like Jordan and Lerone spoke about last night. I think there's an element where we as practitioners need to demonstrate that behavior as well. And sometimes we might be off in a different place and not engaged. I think the most efficient way and the biggest win in a sports science team at the moment, and that's including the coaches involved in that as well, is like being comfortable to be vulnerable with some of the information that you hold and not having all the answers all the time. Being able to have an open discussion and deal with questions that are not easy and be able to engage with other people. So like perhaps not so much a sports science S&C piece, but definitely a kind of a big win in terms of what we've kind of spent a lot of this discussion on, really.
Cool. What about yourself, Rob?
I suppose adding on from what I said about tech and the evolution of tech within the sport, particularly boxing, I guess us as a collective, particularly you guys, potentially can create a fairly easy to use system across the whole of the UK, if not the world, that allows particularly pro fighters within maybe small setups to follow a system to know when they're ready to train. Mm. Using, you know, a clear system of subjective data-informed feedback, you know, affordable data collection, whether that's with a Whoop or just with a Polar H10, whatever, punch trackers, to have this system that allows us to not only periodize in a safe, robust way, but reduce injury, reduce risk of illness, getting them back from illness, etc. So it's a big project. It's probably a PhD, but you know, it's there for the taking. No one's done it. I think the UFC, we were just talking about, the UFC have published an incredible bit of literature that is basically like everything they're doing. It's incredible. And everything from mental, physical, nutrition. So I think that's the future, and I would love to see that from the ground up, from, you know, young fighters to pros, learning a system that's really easy to use so the coaches can use it, everyone understands it, and it's almost like, well, if you're not doing that, then you're an idiot. Like, everyone's doing it because everyone wants the best. And like Ian said, the most important thing is health for the fighters. So we all need to be doing the same thing. Yeah, we can get performance advantages in other ways. Of course, some stuff needs to stay secret to an extent, but most of it needs to be out there.
Absolutely. And this is the reason why we're doing things like this today and over the weekend. We'll open it up for questions. Yeah.
In the data intensive environment that we're looking at key performance indicators, is anyone tracking the fighters in the fight? I'm just thinking performance under the lights on the night is going to be just that little bit perhaps more than they've ever given in training.
Oh, probably. Ian, you can kind of mention about the performance analysts.
Yeah, well, so a couple of things. So we've had performance analysis with us for even beyond our time. And one of the things that we do is we track, we've got all the fights that they do at all the different things. And what the analysis does, they have tags for the different things. So how much time they've spent in the center versus the outside, how many shots they do and everything. Now, in the beginning, that was a very laborious role to do, but with the advances technology, that time has shortened. And now one of the things that's the new future is artificial intelligence, which provides algorithms on software. So literally you could have a video of somebody that you've passed through the software and it tells you what you want to know very quickly. How many shots, how much this, how much distance and everything. So at the moment, our analysts are working with some universities on providing that element of artificial intelligence. On top of that, you know, you mentioned Mike Loosemore and the gum shields. They've piloted these gum shields at one tournament. It was, I think, last year. And then they're piloting again one now, actually with England Boxing going to a junior, just to look at the number of shots they receive and everything. So the answer is yes, but it's still in its infancy on certain metrics. But where it comes to the analysis part of things, without maybe the more inert metrics, that's probably been going on for many years. I mean, people traditionally all have their videos or their phones, but I think our analysts have always looked at a particular detail of things.
But punch power or heart rate high or, you know, those kind of metrics, is anyone tracking that on Fight
Night? No, I think the problem you always have is, so one of the things was the technology, because you need to make sure. So obviously with heart rate now, you can put things under the glove. So actually it's safer, as before you always had to have that. Now you can't really compete with that because it is restrictive. Some boxers don't like it, but those things are changing. Obviously, governing bodies need to allow those things. To get certain metrics in competition, the camera has to be at the right angle, example, an overhead or a particular view to give you those things. Punch power is always going to be hard, because to get that, you either go with the direct method of having things here, but you can't have, what you can have is accelerometers, and you can only do a calculative method of that. The other thing, as I said, going back to the gum shields can provide a true element of power. So they might not know the power hitting, but you know the power receiving, which is basically Newton's law. Whatever comes out, comes back. So it is coming, but it's slowly on those sort of metrics. It's whether they are allowed at the competitions you want them to be allowed to. Example, in a professional bout, at top level, are they going to get both boxers to have these and there, because they're going to be perceived as giving advantage to other people? You see what I mean? Yeah. So one of the things you have is there's a secretive element, is it? You know, you don't want the other boxers to know how hard you hit or what you're doing and whatever. So a lot of the studies, unfortunately, do happen in laboratory settings. But you're right, in competition. But there are certain things. And I think with the advent of technology, it's coming out more and more and more.
Cool. Yeah.
Creates a space. Sorry. It comes back to that vulnerability piece as well. Like, it creates this place where a lot of people have to be vulnerable, because you've all got to agree that you get that data or nobody shares it.
Yeah.
So I think there's an element where, like, governmental systems often force some of these steps forward. So I know, like in cricket with, say, the ball tracking and stuff, that was a system-wide governmental thing starting from the top coming down. With the gum shields, like, they're looking at being able to use them to solve some governance issues, as well as all of the extra, like, mechanical stuff that we get off the back of it. So I think sometimes it's almost taken out of your hands, but it causes that sea change or that step forward in the way that we can do our roles.
It can also be dangerous because if you start getting certain metrics that are showing that the sport is unsafe, mm-hmm. when you start comparing it to your crash dummy hits in a laboratory and some scientist is saying that it is unsafe to do that, yeah. it can actually start counteracting the sport. So I think we're going to see more of those in the next 10 years, you know, using what we'll see more of. But it could be a double-edged sword. Yeah. It can educate. It
sounds like more people be referred to Royal Connect training.
Exactly, exactly. But that's the thing, it's like...
Yeah, you got a question?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask about, in the gym with the boxers, creating like a needs analysis, you know, in terms of their individual programs. So, for example, if you're working in rugby league, you could measure... one relax, back squat, body fat, counter movement, jump, sprint speed. Is it something you do with like the squad? You'd collect the data and then compare them with each other, you know, to gauge what they need to work on, what the strengths are, what the weaknesses are, and how that differs to if you're working just with one individual boxer, you know, the data there, what you compare is, you know, these assessments too.
Yeah, that'd be a good one for you to answer, because obviously he'll do a lot of individual work with boxers, but obviously they're all in team group settings as well. So how do you manage that?
It's a really good question, a really interesting topic. And I think actually when you look at the mechanics of it, like, we've only got so many tests to pick from. So like, yeah, we count the movement jump, we drop jump, we back squat for max strength, we iso squat as well. And we do this battery of tests that is pretty standard, really. The benefit of the fact that it's pretty standard is that we've got like 14 years worth of high quality performance data from every boxer that's been through the system in GB in the past 14 years. So we've got Olympic medalists, we've got world champions, we've got people who've gone on to succeed in the pros. We've got that across weight categories. So we can look back into that data and help. That helps us to inform, identifying what the boxer's strengths are and what the boxer's kind of areas improvement might be. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit more about that when we get to it this afternoon. But in short, yeah, we've got a few things that we can support that with.
Cool. Yeah, Adam?
You talked about how, like, it's multidisciplinary, the coaches that were involved, and I'm almost in communication, we want to make it like it's almost interdisciplinary, if that's a phrase. From a very practical standpoint, how do we as coaches go about that? Is it simple as creating a WhatsApp group with the head coach? And also, what information should we be giving the coach? You don't want to just give them nonsense that they're never ever going to, that's not practical, they're not going to use. So is it things like HRV, their sleep, or what should we be telling the head coaches?
Yeah, I mean, I'll take that. You should ask them. Right. One of the things, I used the word I used before, we assume. We assume what they want to know. We assume what they don't want to know. Same with the athletes. We assume this information is too much for them or not. And athletes surprise us, coaches surprise us. I think if you're trying to create a system of better communication, you ask them, what information would you like? How often would you like it? How would you like to receive it? Because we know these days, you mentioned WhatsApp, it's easy, is it? People pick it up. You send an email, which takes 2 days to read. Nobody's going to read it. But some people like emails. A coach might say, I prefer emails. I never look at my WhatsApp. So you have to think about your stakeholder. Every stakeholder will be different. But the more you can involve people in simple ways of communication, and it doesn't take excessive time for them. One of the problems with WhatsApp is people start dropping too many things. I mean, I've silenced most of my WhatsApp because a lot of it is garbage, is it? And then you find a time where you open it up and you look at it. Otherwise, you're there all day and you think, like, for fuck's sake, can we stop putting in funny pictures of me? but that's what I mean. You need to ask your stakeholders. Always ask them. They may surprise you.
Yeah, what do you want to know? Yeah, so many times I've sent through a performance profile and you'll just get, thanks, mate, rather than actually, oh, yeah, that's good. What does this mean and everything like that? You know, we've had a coach ask to get a boxer's legs stronger, and instead of showing them the data across the gym aware or OptiJump data or anything like that. I just showed them doing a punch specific exercise a little bit better using their legs, and they'll go, yeah, that's great. That's all they wanted to see. And that data then is for us to inform our practice, offer some sort of feedback to the athlete to make sure that they've got that intent and know that they're progressing. But in terms of the like in-depth detail of science, you've got to work out what the coach actually wants and engages with, what the athlete wants and engages with as well.
So some athletes love numbers.
Yeah.
Others, what the fuck is that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you guys all learn differently. Mm. You guys all have different styles. Yeah. Just remember those styles transfer to the people in front of you, and what your preference is might not be the preference of the person in front of you. So it's how do you come across so that you find that level playing field?
Yeah.
Just to chime in a bit quickly on the simple things I think are important, because over the 8 years we worked together, things got better and better over time. And to be honest, as we got older, we had less and less free time, and you all guys running gyms busy. So if you're ringing the nutritionist who's then ringing someone else, and then you're ringing another person who then rings that other person, you're all just wasting time. So in the early days, we'd have all these separate conversations, wouldn't we? And then we just went down to a system of, I mean, not everyone could chime in every week, but 9 o'clock on a Monday, you do a 20-minute Zoom call. Someone has to lead that. Otherwise, everyone's chatting. You've got to have a leader and an agenda. And then you can have the WhatsApp in the background, but you can have coach, nutrition, physio, depending on how many cooks you've got with that athlete on that call. It could be fortnightly, at a time that works for everyone. And, you know, if there's nothing to talk about, then that's good. He's fine. We're on track for the training plan this week. Cool. Have a good week. See you in the gym later on. But that's what worked well for us. And I think in the early days, it was just chaos. Like, and you sometimes find, Jesus, I've been on the phone for like 2 hours today. Like, on the go in my car, always on a call with someone, and it doesn't make any sense. So I think having systems in place, you can end up getting a headache from over communicating. So it needs to be efficient.
Time for one more. Go on, Al. I thought you had all the answers, not the questions.
So mine is about growing the interest around boxing. Have you noticed any increase in interest in youth in boxing correlated to the advancement of sports science related to the sport? Are they correlated or not really? Do we see an increasing pool of youth coming into boxing before the 18, obviously?
We were just having a conversation the other day, myself and Tommy, because we're running the Youth Athlete Initiative. And I think, like, when we first started running that about 4 or 5 years ago, the jumps were pretty poor, the movement weren't great, and we're thinking, right, this is something that we really need to start pushing in strength and conditioning. And we've put out a lot of information about there about youth training, and when we've come to do the testing now post COVID and everything, they seem to be a lot better. You'd say that the jumps are a lot better, the general movement is better as well, so that kind of I feel that a lot more youth boxers are now getting more exposed to more athletic training. The athletic development's coming alongside the technical development. And I think it is down to the top of the filter. You know, Yanti Joshua's, GB Boxing, all these top level professionals now are doing strength and conditioning. So the young ones who are inspired by them are going to go, right, I want to do something like that. Whereas like before, they didn't have that. So that's probably the reason why boxing was behind. And I think like there was like that kind of old school generation still in within professional boxing. The boxers that are around about 35 years old, 34 years old, that started off doing boxing without any kind of influx of strength and conditioning. Now you're getting athletes that are being introduced to strength and conditioning at a younger age. When they get onto GB boxing, straight away they're encouraged by the coaches to do it, rather than it being you might not need that, just stick with your boxing and everything like that. So there's a better approach from the professionals, and that's filtering through. So yeah, We are seeing a bigger change, but I feel that there still needs to be a better system in place for youth boxers, and that's something that we're trying to push with Boxing Science.
The second part of the question is there any correlation between the improvement of the conditioning with the increased interest between the participants that join the sport? The pool of participants that goes into boxing?
Well, no. It won't be the sport science and medicine that attracts the boxer. It'll be the success, particularly at the Olympic Games. And so, you know, more women have joined because they've seen the likes of Nicole Adams win the golds. They've seen the likes of your Savannah Marshalls, who became a world champion, both at an Olympic level, a world champion, but also at a professional now. You know, Natasha Jonas and so on and so forth. So the participation part of things is based on the success. But for them to be successful, they need to be able to have the attributes to be successful. Now, one of the things that we have seen over the years is that before, when boxers joined the program, they had, a lot of them, almost zero experience of being in the strength and conditioning gym. And a lot of them will tell you, well, I'm a boxer. All I want to do is box, without realizing that that actually helps them box. And some boxers are still like this today. No, all I want to do is box. All I want to do is keep on boxing. So the more they are accessing strength and conditioning before they join GB, the quicker they'll progress at GB, the less injuries they will have, and the more they'll go into that. And that keeps on circulating because you have more successful. I mean, think about the last Olympics. We finished second in the Olympic table, GB boxing, just under Cuba. You beat your Kazakhstans, your Uzbekistans, all these other nations. We came away with 6 medals. The biggest medal haul of all time. It doesn't happen by chance, but we're still missing one component. Boxers outside of GB, they're not getting enough exposure to sports science and medicine. They're getting the coaching exposure, even though COVID didn't help. We had 2 years probably where things went a bit down, didn't it? And hopefully we're regaining. But the problem is the exposure. But we're seeing more people coming through now. Gary can tell you, I know he's only been here a short time in boxing, but even we have a new cohort that just joined recently. They already had a very good base of S&C, meaning you can actually expose them quicker to boxing rather than you have to hold them back. So that becomes a great advantage for us as a nation. So you guys doing that base job helps us to create those champions. I know some of them might go straight to pro, still does them a great service, but you know, that helps feed the system and get them to the highest level. So creates that participation through people seeing those people getting the medals up.
So that brings us to the end of this Boxing Science roundtable discussion and the Boxing Science podcast episode. Thank you very much for tuning in. Hope you enjoyed it and taken a lot away so you can start implementing into your coaching practice. If you enjoyed this and you're inspired by this, you should go and check out the Boxing Science Conference online edition that is now available at a 60% discount, and you can get a range of different workshops from strength conditioning to nutrition to physiology and physiotherapy, and also a bit of psychology in there as well. Like I mentioned, it's 60% discount. This ends on Friday, 30th September. So go check it out on the Boxing Science website. And if you're not a subscriber to the podcast yet, please hit the subscribe button so you don't miss out on any future content. Thank you very much. Hopefully see you soon.